thinking about how I might respond to the centenary of the war, I prepared two anthologies of poets, and the first one tried to do one thing, and then that came out for 1914, and then we're trying to do something slightly different for 1918, where we've been sort of through a journey in the war, as it were. And I think both of those anthologies have taken quite a different approach to what we've seen in the past. And of course, you know, anthologists have played a really seminal role in how we receive, to use that sort of term, how we receive poetry of the First World War, and how it influences us, how it's the sort of selections that are made and presented to readers. And I'm very aware that over the past that has influenced hugely how we see the war poetry that we that we read and admire and today. So I was trying to do something consciously quite different. It wasn't just another anthology. I was trying to move things in a slightly different direction. I think it comes back to how when I first read war poetry, it was by that really influential Penguin collection by John Silkin, and he did something there which was very conscious as well. You read, it's a terrific anthology, but he had a very political motive in doing that. For him, the best poetry about the war was the poetry that was anti-war. So he selected certain poets and selected certain poems from certain poets that delivered his agenda, which was, I think, I can't remember the exact date of that, but it was about 1970. So we were in the Cold War, we're in the days of CND, we're in a time when a certain sort of intellectual was quite hostile to war, quite hostile to that sort of interpretation of the world that you could change events through violence. And he had an agenda, and it was very influential. It was very influential on me. I think it determined, certainly, that came out when I was at school. It made me think about war poetry in a certain way, which I then thought about the same way at university. And I don't think I really challenged it, because it wasn't the opportunity to challenge it. That's what I had. That's what I'd been given. So I was aware, not that I'm saying it's going to have this, my anthology have the same impact of John Silkin's, but I'm also being very aware of anthologists like John Stallworthy, who did the Oxford book. John had a very particular view of war poetry, and he certainly did not want to include anybody who wasn't a soldier poet. And that meant for me excluding women. And women have been excluded from this collection of poetry in a way which now seems to me quite remarkable. And and we could talk about why that might be. So in the first anthology I did in 1914, I took 15 poets, and it seemed to me that the impetus for doing that was in 2009, we lost both Harry Patch and Henry Allingham. They were the last Tommies to live. And I think Henry Allingham was 113 and Harry Patch was a mere 111 when he died. But I remember sitting, I think for the first time ever, Westminster Abbey did a special service for the generation of the First World War. And I think it was the first time, well, I know it was the first time, that the Abbey, and the Abbey has a particular role to play at the heart of national life, that the Abbey had said, we are going to mark the end of this generation. The last person of this generation has just died. And that was the last of the generation that had taken an active role in the First World War. And I was there, and I was sitting by chance in Poets' Corner. And I was sitting in a row with children of Robert Graves, of Edmund Blunden, family, the nephew of Wilfred Owen, the granddaughter of Siegfried Sassoon, and it made me think during that service, and it was a very good service in Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, spoke very well, and it made me think, yes, now we're on our own. Harry Patch has gone, Henry, we can no longer go and see someone and ask them what it was like. We have to depend on other records, the testaments that people have given, either recordings they made or videos they made. But more than ever, what we turn to, I guess, is texts and diaries and memoirs, and of course among that is poetry. And I think that's why I value the certain sorts of poets that I value. I think it's because they give that sense of first-hand witness, direct immersion. They've invested completely in their experience of the war. They're immersed in that experience, and they speak, I think, with the authority that comes from direct involvement and direct witness. And the ones I think we admire most these days are poets who speak with that, what you might call a sense of authenticity. And that's quite different to how early anthologies, because these anthologies started coming out in the war and immediately after the war. We don't know how many poets exactly they were writing, but somebody tried to count them. There were certainly over 2,000 people publishing poetry. Now these are in country newspapers and small town newspapers and things they published, but it was a moment in time when poetry was popular and people turned to poetry as a way of expressing themselves or finding consolation or doing something else. And millions of people were reading them. I mean, some of the popular poets of the time, names now we've completely forgotten, they sold hundreds of thousands of copies of individual poems or individual books. And of course, we don't read them anymore. And the early anthologies didn't have the poets we probably most admire today. The anthologies of 1920, there's no Wilfred Owen, there's no Edward Thomas, there's no Ivor Gurney, there's no Isaac Rosenberg. And these are the poets we now look to, I think, as the authentic voice of First World War experience. And so that was what set me thinking about how do we find that authenticity. I think that's what I was looking for, that sense of direct witness. So when I did the anthology for the Imperial War Museum, they asked me if I would do an anthology to commemorate the centenary of the start of the war. I decided a number of things. One was that it would only include poets who were directly involved, who were actively involved. So they weren't people who were reading about the experience secondhand in the newspapers. Not that they weren't necessarily writing good poems, but because some of them were. But I was looking for a different sort of authenticity and this sense of direct witness. And so I chose 15 poets there. And I did something different, I think, partly by selecting down to 15 poets, but also by including people who went to the war but not with a gun in their hand. So that meant we had some women in there. And I think that does change the dynamic very strongly. When you think back to, it's interesting to see what was also happening at that time. It was clear that the government wanted the centenary of the war. Well, certainly certain politicians wanted the centenary of the war to do something. So you may remember David Cameron, when he was Prime Minister, got into a bit of trouble when he used the C word. He said we need to celebrate the First World War. And people quickly told him that it really wasn't something he celebrated. I think it was Angela Merkel, actually, who told him that. Michael Gove, who was Secretary of State for Education, he went into the media saying, we should be proud of the fact that we won. Why weren't we proud of the fact that we'd won? Well, that's a very good question, I think. But we don't seem to be that proud of the fact that we won. You know, maybe certain people are, but maybe not a widely held view. And that also made me think the poets who have been consistently popular, right from the beginning, have been Robert Gray's Secret Sassoon. And then once Owen's poems were published in 1926, they also became very, very popular. And those three, of course, were friends during the war. And they were all trying to do the same thing, which was that they were all trying to shock people back home. And Robert Graves started it, if you like. He deliberately wanted to write poems that probably shocked his family, shocked his friends, shocked people who were waving flags and saying it was a wonderful thing and our brave young boys are going off to fight and teaching the Hun a lesson. He really didn't like any of that. And so he wrote poems that he thought would shock them with their reality. And of course that was artificial in its own sense, because he exaggerated, he selected certain sort of subjects and gave us a close-up on certain horrors that hadn't been a feature of poetry up until then. And his first book came out just after the beginning of the war, and it shows that he was determined to do that even before he went, because there was a review in the Times that said a particular poem shows the real realities of trench life. And of course, he'd written it while he was still at training camp in Britain. He'd written a dramatic piece about being in the trenches, but only as he was imagining it. And of course, it got much worse when he got there. Mm. So he would, you know, write in great detail about dead bodies he found and things like that. And that had a certain arresting response from people. And Sassoon was in the same regiment, same battalion. And Sassoon at that time was writing poems that were really quite romantic, quite heroic. Return to greet me, colours that were my joy, you know, because everything's gone khaki and things. And, you know, red is now just blood. And Gray said, you can't write about that. It's write about what we're seeing here, you know. Sassoon, on the other hand, read Graves' poems and thought they were repulsive, that you shouldn't write about the war so honestly and so brutally. But of course he completely changed, he became more extreme than Graves. And then Owen joined that group when Sassoon was sent to Craig Lockhart hospital for people suffering from shell shock. He and Owen became friends, and Owen outdid them all, you know, in the way he wrote. And it also struck me doing this, Graves in particular would have been rather perturbed and puzzled by the fact that those poems the three of them wrote, you know, they wrote them deliberately to rattle the cage of the establishment. And it seemed to me that they're still rattling the cage, because the response of ministers and some historians is that they've distorted the way we read the war, we understand the war. So not only were they unpopular with the establishment during the war, they're still unpopular with the establishment because they don't like, you know, the version of the war they're presenting. And that's proved a very enduring narrative. Something about that narrative has caught our imagination and sticks in it. You know, and Niall Ferguson, I've got this quote here, he says, the persistence of the idea that the war was a bad thing owes much to the genre known as war poetry, inverted commas, usually meaning anti-war, which became firmly established in British school curriculums in the 1970s. So I think it's a really interesting comment. So he's blaming the poets, blaming the teachers for the idea that the First World War was a bad thing. Well, I don't know about you, but I tend to think the First World War was a pretty bad thing. You know, I'm not sure that the deaths of 9 million people and the many, many millions more lives that, you know, that were affected through injury or through mental breakdown or through grief or whatever, I'm not sure they got a lot in return. That. They didn't have a lot to show at the end of it all. But of course there's this narrative that says, you know, despite David Cameron, despite Michael Gove, despite Niall Ferguson, people keep asking the question, you know, was the war justified? Was it necessary to have that war? You know, did a generation of politicians lie to the people? Did the older generation lie to the younger generation? And it, to use Vera Brittain's phrase, did they seduce them? Or hypnotize them, is another word she uses, into the state of acceptance that the war was a good thing? You know, were lions really led by donkeys? Was it all a waste? And so Wilfred Owen and Graves and Sassoon are still getting the blame for that. But it seems to me, you know, that itself is a bit of a myth. You know, there are lots of myths around the First World War, but there's also a myth that our current interpretation of the war can be blamed on poets. You know, I think when I was a student, or when I was at school, I knew the difference between poetry and history. I think my teachers knew the difference between poetry and history. I don't think I was confused by them. I knew that what I was reading was the voice of a person who'd been there. But because it was a compelling voice, and it spoke to me with a sense of directness and authenticity, I paid attention, I think, and I paid close attention to that, much more than I did to the history books I was also reading. And I think that's an uncomfortable truth for them. And of course it does come down to other things, coming back to what we were talking about earlier, where he said that, you know, anthologists choose and they present a certain selection of people. And by eliminating lots of other things, you are, you know, by taking stuff out, you're left with a certain thing. And if you only give a narrative, that's one narrative, I think you're misleading people, because certainly the poets I've chosen, both my anthologies, they had many different attitudes to the war, because many people had different attitudes to the war, and a number of very good poets weren't against the war. They were quite supportive of the war. And a number of people changed their view in the middle of it, or halfway through it. And so the reaction of, you know, the real story of the poetry of the war is, you know, it's complex. And the attitudes to the war are really wide-ranging, and they're ambiguous. People didn't know what to think. They were trying to make sense of it all. And I think that just reflects, that probably reflects more closely what life was like. People had lots of different views. Some people were very enthusiastic. Others were horrified. You know, thought the whole thing was wrong from day one, like Charles Sawley. But others were, you know, were swept up in it.